from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again from London, I know that if I talk about any of my own projects on this broadcast, I am supposed to mention my new record, Can't Take a Hint. So consider it having been mentioned. Amazon, iTunes, Spotify, or for fans of Yiddish music, Spotify. But this, ladies and gentlemen, is about another project, a documentary film I made that showed around the country last year. It's now on Netflix and Hulu. It's called The Big Uneasy. Many of you may know ad nauseum that it's the story of the leaders of two investigations into the real cause of the 2005 New Orleans flood and of a whistleblower inside the Army Corps of Engineers who found serious shortcomings in the new improved system, the system which folks were very glad to announce had worked during Hurricane Isaac, although, as mentioned on this broadcast, some serious warning signs related to those pumps cited by the whistleblower did appear. Two words to remind you: wacky gauges. Anyway, I made the film because I despaired of the national media's continued refusal to pick up this story, the why of the disaster they covered so breathlessly for a few days before they split. Before I made the film, I did something else, although this is not my preferred way of doing things. Early in this administration, a couple of friends said they could reach David Axelrod, the president's chief advisor, and perhaps pave the way for him and me to talk about all of this. Long story short, after a couple months of phone tag, Axelrod's office put me in contact with the legislative liaison person for the United States Army Corps of Engineers. In other words, I had called to report a burglary, and they'd connected me to the burglar's PR man. This year, I got similarly tempted one more time. At a conference in Aspen, I serendipitously ran into the new president of a major radio organization. See how discreet I'm being? No names. This radio organization prides itself on being a reliable news source. You may even consider it one. He said, "You tweeted something funny about me." I said, "You got 2 minutes? You got 5 minutes." So we sat down, and I told him how his organization had not only missed this story and refused to report on the film that didn't miss the story, but it also refused to allow us to advertise the film because these words, quote, "documentary about why New Orleans flooded," quote, unquote, violated some mysterious policy. He listened attentively, asked some good questions, and at the end of the conversation, I offered to send him the film and let him see for himself. He was new on the job. He said he'd like that. So since then, I've emailed him every 2 weeks or so to see if he'd seen the film and had any kind of reaction to the story it told. This is now 3 months down the line. As of this week, he still hadn't been able to find the 93 minutes to watch it. He said he had sent it down to the news department. The same department up to now had never seen fit to cover the story of why New Orleans flooded. And that was that. It almost makes you think that the personal touch may be overrated. You can certainly say that for my charisma. Anyway, he told me in his final email this week that he was sorry if I was disappointed. Ladies and gentlemen, I wasn't disappointed. That would require having had expectations. Please give. Hello, welcome to the show. From London, England, overlooking historic Leicester Square, which has just been tarted up to coincide with the Olympics. And it looks exactly the same as it did the year ago, before they started the work. Interesting. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. I am so tired. But Leicester Square is full of movie theaters, including one which is showing right now a movie which the marquee proclaims is unmissable. And I'm racked with guilt, because not only have I missed it, I've chosen to miss it. What a bad person I must be. Now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. This from The Guardian. In Vakilabad prison, northern Iran, there's a beam that can take up to 60 nooses. Vakilabad's record is 89 executions in one day. The true number of those executed in Iran is impossible to quantify, especially for those convicted of drug offenses, but it's clear there's a large disjunction between official figures and the reality. In the 12 months to November last year, there were at least 600 executions, 81% of which were for drugs offenses. And among increasingly vocal human rights groups, the concern now is that Britain has unwittingly helped fuel the killing machine. Why the death toll rising in Iran is happening is open to conjecture. Some believe the Iranian authorities are nervous about the Arab Spring, are using drug laws as an excuse to eliminate their opponents. But there is also a greater resolve in Iran to tackle the drugs trade. Iran, of course, is right across the border from Afghanistan. According to documents obtained by The Observer, the United Kingdom, Britain, was one of five donor countries that via the United Nations gave almost $3.4 million to train drug-sniffing dogs, also providing specialized vehicles, satellite phones, drug testing kits, and body scanners. In 2009, the Foreign Office confirmed it had spent more than £3 million, that would be $5 million, providing counter-narcotics assistance in Iran. Even trafficking small amounts can prove fatal in Iran. Iran's not the only country that uses the death penalty involving drug offenses to have received British aid. The UK was one of six countries that via the UN gave $6 million to Pakistan and a further $11 million in 2010 to support anti-drug programs. The UN has a counter-trafficking memorandum of understanding with six East Asian countries, of which five retain the death penalty for drug offenses. At least $26 million has gone to these countries' counter-narcotics programs via the UN. Now, politicians are questioning the wisdom of a policy that appears contrary to Britain's own guidance to officials, who were warned that prior to providing assistance, they must obtain assurances confirming that anyone found guilty would not face the death penalty. A British government spokesman declined to give details about which country's counter-narcotics programs it had funded. In May, the UN published a paper that acknowledged it placed itself, quote, in a very vulnerable position vis-a-vis its responsibility to respect human rights, unquote, if it funded countries that actively supported the death penalty for drugs offenses. This is your brain on the war on drugs, ladies and gentlemen. And from the Sydney Morning Herald in Australia, way down under, comes this. Long-held claims by the former detainee David Hicks, the Australian who was detained in Guantanamo Bay, that he was drugged against his will have been backed by evidence from a prominent attorney, independent investigations, and previously secret reports. Details of the mistreatment of the former Guantanamo Bay inmate were going to emerge publicly for the first time in the Australian government's proceedings against him until the government abandoned its case. It would have been Hicks' first day in a properly constituted court, but prosecutors decided that their case to seize revenue from his book about his Gitmo experience would not stand up. Hicks' lawyers would have used new evidence from U.S. authorities that would have then become public. By dropping the case, the shutters have been brought down on what happened. Some documents will be kept secret. The Australian Sun Herald understands these documents were expected to shed light on the treatment of detainees. The Sun Herald has been given affidavits that were to be presented in court confirming that Hicks had been drugged against his will. Detainees, according to other investigations at Guantanamo, were forced to take high dosages of the controversial anti-malaria drug mefloquine despite showing no signs of malaria, an unprecedented practice that has been likened by a U.S. military doctor to pharmacologic waterboarding. Waterboarding without the water saves water. Questions have been raised about whether the mass administration of the drug to detainees was a secret illegal experiment after a medical journal last month by an Army doctor, Major Remington Nevin, highlighted the, quote, inappropriate use of the drug, asking if its use had been motivated by its psychotic side effects. The U.S. Center for Disease Control has issued a warning against the use of mefloquine on anyone suffering psychiatric disturbances or having a history of depression. Being Guantanamo couldn't make you depressed, could it? Dr. Nevin has also warned that high doses of the drug can cause brain injuries. Evidence, including previously secret reports and witnesses, including a Guantanamo guard, support Hicks's claims that he was drugged. A New York lawyer, Josh Dratel, who has top security clearance from the Department of Justice and has acted on behalf of a number of detainees, including Hicks, was going to give direct evidence of the non-therapeutic drugging in his affidavit prepared for the trial. He revealed that U.S. prosecutors admitted Hicks's claim that guards had forced him to eat a meal which contained a sedative before they read him the charges, that was true. He was told it had been done to protect the officers from what they feared would be his reaction. Former Guantanamo guard Brandon Neely also supplied an affidavit for the trial saying detainees were regularly beaten for refusing to take the medications. Neely has also said doctors never told the detainees what drugs they were being given. Just what drugs were being administered in some cases may never be known. Medical records are apparently incomplete, with names and dosages of some drugs removed. Further evidence of forced druggings by injection at Guantanamo revealed in a previously secret DOD, Department of Defense, intelligence report into allegations of the use of mind-altering drugs to facilitate interrogation. The report, obtained under freedom of information laws by Truth Out, uncovered evidence that psychoactive medication was administered to detainees for mental health purposes and that these injections were sometimes forced with uncooperative detainees. It also found the detainees were being treated with psychoactive drugs that impaired their mental functions while they were being interrogated under the effects of the medication. After 6.5 years in detention, Hicks made an Alford plea, meaning he acknowledged the evidence but did not make any admissions. That meant he was convicted in the U.S. of providing material support for terrorism, but he was allowed to go back to Australia and serve a 7-month prison sentence. He claims he's living in Sydney now. He claims the pain he suffers as a result of the druggings means that he now relies on painkillers. A week before his case was to go to trial, the Commonwealth Director of Prosecutions dropped the case. When he returned to Australia and was serving his 7-month term in a prison, he requested blood tests be taken to determine what drugs he'd been given. He was refused. By the time he was released, it was too late to detect traces in his system. News from... It does make you proud, doesn't it? News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. Now, if you want to hear... First of all, I'm in London. I'm not in the United States, and I won't be for a little while. Not really going to be able to be the guy you depend on for, you know, making fun of the particular day-to-day things that may be said, amusing though they may be, in the political campaign. For you know, you'll have to watch cable news for that. But, you know, because people do say dumb things during campaigns. But here's one that I caught today on British television I thought you might enjoy. It's by Harvey Weinstein, well-known film producer, with a well-known temperament. And he's on a British television chat show, as they call him over here, to promote a play that he's producing here in Britain. But he's also here. He took the opportunity while he was on that broadcast to respond to quash accusations that he'd ever asked Quentin Tarantino to tone down the violence in his films. So rest assured, ladies and gentlemen, Harvey Weinstein has never asked Quentin Tarantino to tone down the violence. Whew, that was a close one. But he also took the opportunity to talk a little politics. And he alluded to the fact that right at the beginning of the Olympics, Mitt Romney had come over here and had said some embarrassing things. And then he said this. Then he said this.
On behalf of my love of England, I have to support the president who, you know what I mean, is anything but making faux pas. He's strong. He's smart. Mitt Romney didn't want to, you know, launch the missile to kill Osama bin Laden. You know, he was clear about that. The president did that.
The missile that killed Osama bin Laden. Did you notice that? I guess that SEAL Team 6 guy really did lie in that book. Wow. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. Maybe that was just a movie in Harvey's mind. An apology by Kelvin McKenzie, who was editor of the Sun newspaper, the now shuttered... No, sorry, the Sun is still publishing. The Sun tabloid owned by Nice Corp. At the time of a Hillsborough tragedy when a lot of fans at a sporting event found themselves dead in the... in the exodus from the venue. All right, so that was what happened. An apology by Kelvin McKenzie, who was the editor of the Sun newspaper at the time of that tragedy, has been rejected by a man who lost his 2 teenage daughters at Hillsborough. McKenzie, an editor of the Sun, the editor of the Sun, when the paper ran a front-page story blaming the fans for their deaths and injury, this week offered his, quote, profuse apologies to the people of Liverpool. McKenzie, who wrote the headline, The Truth, on the controversial report that blamed the fans, said in a statement, "Today I offer my profuse apologies to the people of Liverpool for that headline. The Sun's report accused Liverpool fans of stealing from the dying, urinating on policemen, and beating up on an officer giving the kiss of life." Quote from his apology, "I too was totally misled. 23 years ago, I was handed a piece of copy from a reputable news agency in Sheffield in which a senior police officer and a senior local member of parliament were making serious allegations against fans in the stadium, he said in his apology. I had absolutely no reason to believe that these authority figures would lie and deceive over such a disaster. It has taken more than 2 decades, 400,000 documents, and a 2-year inquiry to discover, to my horror, that would have been far more accurate had I written the headline, "The Lies," rather than "The Truth." I published in good faith, and I am sorry that it was so wrong. Unquote. Trevor Hicks of the Hillsborough Family Support Group rejected McKenzie's apology as, quote, too little, too late, calling him, quote, low life, clever low life, but low life. Well, he's trying to be nice. McKenzie's apology is in stark contrast to his previous comments about the tragedy. Speaking 5 years ago, he said he was not sorry for the way his paper covered events at Hillsborough. He said he only apologized at the time because he was told to by his boss, Rupert Murdoch. That followed comments reportedly made at a private dinner where he was alleged to have said, I'm not sorry then and I'm not sorry now. The Sun did print a full-page apology in 2004 describing its coverage as the most terrible mistake in its history. The reporter who wrote the Sun's story said he was aghast at the headline. When I saw the headline, "The Truth," I was aghast because that wasn't what I'd written. I never used the words "the truth," said the reporter. He said his editor, McKenzie, told him not to worry. And after the crash, this was the headline. "The truth, some fans picked pockets of victims, some fans urinated on the brave cops, some fans beat up policemen giving kiss of life." A British government inquiry into the police's handling of the disaster concluded this week that members of the South Yorkshire Police altered 164 documents during the investigation in an effort to blame the fans for the disaster and to distract attention from their own failure to control the crowd or even notice that fans were being asphyxiated yards from the field. It found that police and a local Conservative member of parliament fed false information about fans' behavior that day, which the Sun used to create its headline. The fans were not drunk, nor did they arrive without tickets and force their way in. This was the biggest cover-up, says a prominent British lawyer, in British legal history. It was the Sun what did it. But it's nice people doing very, very, very nice things.
I'd hate to call you a liar, but I don't believe you. I know how you're going to vote.
You don't know how I'm good. Voting is the least of the problems, Rupert. But thank you so much for dropping by. And now, ladies and gentlemen, you loving autumn, Addie?
Yeah. My protons are turning.
Color?
No, just turning.
Officials say the troubled Fort Calhoun nuclear power plant isn't like this is in Omaha, Nebraska, isn't likely to start again anytime soon. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission will offer another update on the plant, but utility officials have abandoned their earlier goal of restarting Fort Calhoun plant this fall. The plant initially shut down for routine maintenance in 2011, but flooding along the Missouri River, who could have expected that? And several safety violations have forced it to remain offline.
It's nutty. Who thinks a river?
I know. The Inspector General of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission confirmed it has begun an independent investigation of the cleanup of the BWX Technologies nuclear waste dump in Parks, Pennsylvania. The dump along Route 66 might be worth a visit. Known formally as the Shallow Land Disposal Area, received radioactive and chemical waste. It was operated by Atlantic Richfield previously. BWX was formerly known as Babcock and Wilcox, which it is known as again. They all produce nuclear fuel for submarines and a range of nuclear products for the federal government and private industry. The Inspector General's office has declined to provide details on the investigation, as has the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, so we don't really know what's wrong with the dump. The darkened San Onofre nuclear power plant will not restart even one of its 2 reactors for months, the head of the NRC said this week. In the meantime, analysis has been issued by anti-nuclear advocates showing the issues with San Onofre steam generators are among the worst in the industry.
That's a good industry.
The plant has been shuttered since beginning of the year when a tube, as you know, in one of the plant's newly replaced steam generators leaked. And they found that the tubes were wearing out more rapidly than expected. The plants aren't restarting.
Good, need to build more.
Halliburton crew members who lost a radioactive rod used in drilling wells in West Texas weren't guilty of criminal conduct, says the FBI, as a hunt for that missing radioactive tool enters its fourth, probably now fifth day. FBI officials working with the Texas Department of Transportation questioned three employees who were unable to locate the device this week after it went missing on a 130-mile route from Pecos to Odessa, according to a Nuclear Regulatory Commission incident report. The FBI would only say that they believed there was no criminal activity involved with the missing tool. A well near Pecos where the device was last used has been searched three times, according to the NRC.
They could try a fourth.
A National Guard unit based in Austin sent a three-person team with detection gear to assist local officials. The Texas Department of State Health Services said it requested help to find the radioactive item, which can pose a health risk if touched or held for several days. Halliburton lost the unit on September 11th. Pickup trucks with detection gear retraced the route. The trucks drove at 10 miles an hour without finding the unit. It's not something that produces radiation in an extremely dangerous form, said a spokesman for the health department, but it's best for people to stay back 20 or 25 feet.
That's true of anything.
A Soviet K-27 submarine suffered a nuclear accident before being dumped at the bottom of the Kara Sea 30 years ago. We discussed this, I think, last week. Russia may now have to lift the sub from dangerously shallow waters before an uncontrolled chain reaction causes fatal damage. Radiation leakages will come sooner or later if we just leave the K-27 there. It was rusty even before it was sunken. Leakages of radioactivity underwater are nearly impossible to clean up, says Thomas Nielsen, the nuclear safety expert who has extensively mapped radioactive waste on the Arctic seabed. The K-27 was ill-fated from its launch in 1962. It made only three voyages, the last of which in 1968 ended in tragedy. Its reactor malfunctioned, and the brave but badly trained crew made a futile attempt to fix it. Instead of solving the problem, they were exposed to fatal doses of radiation. Nine seamen died, most of them in hospital in agony from radiation sickness several days after the accident. The incident was kept secret by the Soviet government for decades. The families of the victims received no compensation. After repeated plans to redesign the sub, Soviet authorities decided it was easier to dump it. International guidelines say decommissioned vessels should be buried at least 3,000 meters under the sea. This is sitting at about 75 meters. And at what was once one of the most remote places on Earth is now a hub of commercial activities, with the melting ice caps providing greater opportunities for fishing. In a letter submitted Friday after... Addie, you have no comment.
It's the Soviets. What do you want?
In a letter submitted this week to internal investigators at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a whistleblower engineer within the agency accused regulators of deliberately covering up information relating to the vulnerability of U.S. nuclear power facilities that sit downstream from large dams and reservoirs. A lot of them do because they need cooling water, don't they?
Yes, they do.
The letter also accuses the agency of failing to act to correct these vulnerabilities despite being aware of them for years. These charges were echoed in separate conversations with another risk engineer inside the agency who suggested the vulnerability at one plant in particular, the Oconee station near Seneca, South Carolina, three reactors, put it at risk of a flood and subsequent system failure should an upstream dam completely fail. That would be similar to the tsunami that hobbled Fuk. In a letter, a copy of which was obtained by the Huffington Post, Richard Perkins, a reliability and risk engineer within the NRC Risk Analysis Division, accused NRC officials of falsely invoking security concerns in redacting large portions of a report detailing the agency's preliminary investigation into the potential for flooding at U.S. nuclear power plants due to upstream dam failure. Including Oconee, the report examined similar vulnerabilities at Fort Calhoun in Nebraska, the Prairie Island facility in Minnesota, and the Watts Bar plant in Tennessee, among others. Perkins was the lead author of that report. It was completed July a year ago. It concluded that the failure of one or more dams sitting upstream from several nuclear power plants, quote, may result in flood levels at a site that render essential safety systems inoperable, unquote. High floodwaters can conceivably undermine all available power sources, the report found, including grid power, emergency diesel, backup generators, and ultimately battery backups. The risk of these things happening, the report said, is higher than acceptable. The NRC made a heavily redacted copy of the report publicly available on the NRC website.
Redactions are good.
And Indian Point in New York State's new perimeter security system crashes regularly and the nuclear power plant routinely fails anti-terrorism drills, a security lieutenant at the plant claims in a $1.5 billion lawsuit.
What's with these whistleblowers?
Clinton Skip Travis Jr. is suing Entergy, owner of the plant, claiming that its emphasis on profits over security led to the installation of the new monitoring system without adequate training. He said he's been kept out of work for months because of his criticism of the company's handling of security issues, including complaints to state and federal officials.
He's disgruntled.
The lawsuit also names several Entergy subsidiaries. Travis said in an interview this week that a terrorist attack on the plant is inevitable. This is not a vendetta, he said. This is holding them accountable. The lawsuit paints a doomsday picture of what security lapses could mean to those living in the so-called meltdown zone. He said in each of the past 2 years, the plant's force-on-force drills where mock adversaries attacked the plant ended with the, quote, terrorists, unquote, taking over their intended targets. Since he was hired, he said, the terrorists have won at least half the times. One of the times the security force won, he said, was during a choreographed drill when the attackers were made to run uphill at fixed positions because it was raining and he wanted to speed up the drill so nobody would get hurt. He also contends the company and NRC officials were so concerned the plant would fail its drill this year, they canceled it just a few days before it was scheduled, citing a safety concern that rifles used in the drills were emitting too much carbon dioxide.
They're going green over there.
Yes, they are. Clean, safe, chafe tape, too cheap to make him. Our friend, the Atom.
Summer was gone and the heat died down. And autumn reached for a golden crown. I looked behind as I heard a sigh. But this was the time of no reply. The sun went down and the crowd went home. I was left by the roadside all alone. I turned to speak as they went by. But this was the time of no reply. Nothing to say. They would keep their dreams till another day. So they stood and thought and wondered why. For this was the time of no reply. Time goes by from year to year, and no one asks why I'm standing here. But I have my answer as I look to the sky. This is the time of no reply. The time of no reply is calling me to stay. There's no hello and no goodbye. Was gone and the heat died down, and autumn reached for her golden crown. I looked behind as I heard a sigh, But this was the time of no reply.
Secretive film creates a religious uproar, and it's not the one you've heard about.
And Extra Access tonight's special report for mid-September 2012.
Hi, everyone. I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo. Detoxed again.
In the movie business, controversy is usually good news. It means more business.
But this week, a sneak peek at what may be a controversial new film has got many fundamentalists up in arms. Literally.
Extra Access Tonight has pieced together from parts of the story reported on other TV shows most of what we know about this still-developing story. It begins with a thumb drive that showed up last week in some West Texas churches.
In my morning mail, along with free will gifts and offerings from my radio ministry, was this little bitty drive, was what my assistant Gail called it. She put it in her computer, and for the next 4.5 minutes, we couldn't believe how shocked we continued to be. So that night, we fellowshiped with some of our brethren in the leadership of the born-again community, and by 9:15 we had decided to join together, despite our occasional doctrinal differences, to fight back against this evil, because that's what free will gifts and offerings are for.
The evil Reverend Pete Jeter saw was a teaser trailer for Mad Men of God, which portrays Jesus Christ as a 1950s-era advertising genius alive in Roman times. In the trailer, he alternates between creating campaigns for his hot new religion and having equally hot campaigns between the sheets.
Here's what we ran up the flagpole. Heavenly Father, right now my testament is skewing heavily female. Some of the apostles think we need to tweak the optics. Me, I think it's a heck of a blessing.
What I was trying to do was update the classic 1920s book, The Man Nobody Knows.
Film producer Ibrahim Al-Fahari. His voice has been disguised by too much yelling.
About Jesus as an ad salesman. We had wealthy investors from Abu Dhabi who wanted to tell the truth about Christianity. We shot it over a six-month period with a cast of over 100. That thumb drive, which contains just a piece of the rough cut, somehow escaped from the edit facility in 29 Palms. This was not our plan. Our plan was for a big premiere, complete with Joan Rivers being catty.
But once word got out through church Facebook pages about the film and its financing, outrage started spreading faster than hot syrup on a half stack.
Since there are no consulates from Abu Dhabi or other Gulf Emirates in Texas, protests took other forms. In Midland, Guy Dibbler, who had pleaded guilty to stink bombing a Planned Parenthood clinic, led a series of round-the-clock vigils, some of which turned nasty, at the homes of local Arabs, Turks, Sikhs, and Mexicans.
We started real peaceful-like, but turns out I had some stink juice left over from the other operation. So we bombed a couple of falafel stands. Mexicans, they were customers at the stands at the time. That was just a happy accident.
Back in Hollywood, stories about the making and makers of Mad Men of God were leaking out. Abby Gadget is a veteran actress in the adult film industry.
We all feel betrayed by Mr. Al-Farahi. First of all, it turns out his name is really Al-Zahiri. Worse, we all hired on to do a very different movie, a softcore takeoff on Mad Men called Mad Babes. Nothing about religion or Jesus or anything. He was just an ad man in the desert with an enormous, I guess you on TV you're supposed to call it, an enormous endowment.
I call it my converter.
You can save me anytime, mister.
You can call me Master.
They dubbed all the religious dialogue in during lunch the day we shot it. And I think it gives the whole as I like to call it, San Fernando Valley, a bad name.
Now, in the latest twist, it turns out that Ibrahim al-Zahiri is really the son of billionaire Russian oligarch Nikolai Bereshevsky. And there are internet rumors that he made the porn film to settle a large gambling debt. What happened then is still a mystery.
What isn't a mystery is the continued outrage of many Southern Christians. Again, activist Guy Dibbler.
Hell, if the Lord tells me I got to move on up to another level and start firebombing the vehicles of visiting Russian dignitaries, I'll do it. He's the shepherd. I'm only one flocker.
We'll keep on this story until more photos of naked English royalty emerge.
That wraps it for this edition, but Inside Extra Access tonight comes rolling back tomorrow with the results of our latest IEAT poll.
We asked you how you like 3D movies, and the results will have you punching yourself straight in the face.
Till then, I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo. So long from Culver City.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
So sorry.
Dateline Pembroke Pines, Florida. On the 11th anniversary of 9/11, students from Coconut Palm Elementary in Miramar showed up at local Walmart clad in patriotic red, white, and blue to sing God Bless America as part of a prearranged tribute. The group's excitement turned to disappointment Tuesday evening when a Walmart representative refused to honor an agreement allowing the chorus to sing inside the store. In an attempt to right a wrong, school staff and parents led the singers outside the store, where they gathered under a nearby flag that was at half-staff. Wednesday evening responded to complaints about the incident. A Walmart spokeswoman apologized. "We regret this happened and apologize to the students, parents, and the school for this experience," says Kayla Whaling. Kayla Whaling. "Unfortunately, this was a situation of miscommunication, and it should have been handled differently." She added, "We're also inviting the kids back to the store to help honor the victims and fallen heroes. And maybe buy something?" In a remarkably open letter to alumni, the head of an elite school for boys in San Jose, California, apologized to a graduate of the school who claims he was sexually molested on campus by a Jesuit brother 4 decades ago. "There is nothing that we take more seriously than the protection of our students," wrote the Reverend Paul Sheridan, president of Bellarmine College Prep, in an email to hundreds of graduates. He called the victim's story credible. Sheridan said he was alerting graduates due to the responsibility of transparency. His letter was followed by an official statement from the Jesuits' main office in California. "We desire to further the healing of anyone harmed by a Jesuit." Both the letter and the religious order statement named the victim and the alleged molester, Brother William Farrington, who supervised the students living on campus from the mid-60s to the mid-70s. Molestation apparently did not come to light until recently when the former student decided to come forward. Farrington was removed from the school following a different allegation. He could not be reached for comment. He apparently lives at a Jesuit center in Los Gatos. Microsoft will cooperate with the European Commission to open Windows 8 for consumers who prefer using an Internet Explorer web browser rival. This sounds like a story from 17 years ago. CEO Steve Ballmer has assured the head of the European Competition Commission that the software giant will work with the committee and other web browser makers to keep its latest operating system open to competition. In July, the commission had raised concerns about how Microsoft was not complying with obligations to provide consumers a choice in web browsing software. He already warned the American company of immediate action if it admitted the absence of a web browser choice screen in the Windows 7 server pack. Remorseful for its error, Microsoft apologized. "We have fallen short in our responsibility to do this. Due to a technical error, we missed delivering the software to PCs that came with the service pack. 1, update to Windows 7. We deeply regret this error occurred and we apologize for it." I'd say it needs a patch. I want you to go ahead and install the patch. Domain register on web hosting company GoDaddy said an outage this week, which brought down an untold number of websites, was not the result of a hacker attack. It was not caused by external influences, the company's interim CEO said in a statement. It was not a hack. It was not a denial of service attack. The outage affected many GoDaddy customers starting around 10 a.m. on September 7th. In a statement, the interim CEO said that no time was any customer data at risk or were any of our systems compromised. He also apologized to customers for the mishap and thanked them for their patience. What exactly caused the outage, however, is still unclear because it's the information age. The Prime Minister of Belgium, Elio Di Rupo, apologized for the complicity of state authorities in the murder of Belgian Jews during the Holocaust. You may remember a couple weeks ago the mayor of Brussels acknowledged the role of city authorities in deporting Jews, but added, "It is not for me to pass judgment." Well, here's the Prime Minister of Belgium now saying, "We must have the courage to look at the truth. There was steady participation by the Belgian state authorities in the persecution of Jews." He also said he wished to remove any ambiguity regarding Belgian authorities' role in deportations. So take that, Mayor Freddy. And an Estonian weekly newspaper apologized for a mock ad for weight loss pills that used a photo of prisoners at a Nazi concentration camp. The fake ad appeared in the humor section of the Eesti Express with the caption, 1, 2, 3, Dr. Mengele's weight loss pills work wonders. It was designed to mock a recent ad for an Estonian gas company that used a photo of the front gate of Auschwitz on its website to sell its product. That apology we had on this program either last week or the week before. So, at Wacky Estonia, the recently installed president of Yemen has apologized to President Obama for an attack on the U.S. embassy in Yemen's capital city of Sana'a. Yemen President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi apologized and ordered an investigation into the incident, which he said was part of a larger conspiracy to derail Yemen's close relationship with the United States. Democratic officials apologized this week for mistakenly displaying an image of the Russian Navy during a tribute to America's veterans at last week's Democratic National Convention. The warships, many of Soviet origin, were shown on a giant screen above 50 veterans while they were honored. The former sailor who spotted the error and notified Navy Times had asked for an apology. The DNC said it was due to vendor error. Libya's new leadership, scrambling to preserve ties with Washington after U.S. helped overthrow Gaddafi, vowed to find those behind the Benghazi attack. Interim President al-Megarif apologized to the United States for what he called the cowardly assault in Benghazi, which killed several Libyan security guards as well as the U.S. ambassador, Christopher Stevens. And, as it promised, NBC did not apologize on the air Wednesday for its decision not to observe a moment of silence during the Today Show on 9/11, but Steve Capus, president of NBC News, did send out a message to the managers of NBC's affiliated stations, which acknowledged they had been hit with a storm of criticism from their viewers over the decision, and he apologized for putting the stations through that. What happened was, instead of a moment of silence, which the Today Show didn't always observe, today was in the middle of a segment, an interview with Kris Jenner, the matriarch of the Kardashian clan, who was discussing her breast augmentation. Happy 9/11, everyone. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now from the aforementioned Can't Take a Hint, Jamie Cullum on the current mode of accountability.
They always say a fish thinks from its head, but what if it started from the tail instead? Just a few bad apples messing up the bunch. A few bad apples bringing up your lunch. Just a few germs can start a common cold. Just a few cells dying off make you so very old. It's just a few bad apples. They're so rotten to the core. A few bad apples, maybe several more. Don't be angry, save the outrage. Don't get mad, it's just those few bad apples. Not spending time in chapels, just those few apples. Around the top of that tree, 'cause the rotten fruit is hanging so close to you and me. Just a few drums can start up a parade. Every time, oh, a few bad apples, no suspects are to crime. An answer that's this simple makes me glad. There'll always be those apples, drinking more than Snapples. Just a few bad apples going bad.
And now, news of the Olympic movement. Really, news of the after effects of the Olympic movement. Gloomy figures outlining the Olympic sales slump in Britain, crushing the retail sector, will emerge this week as retailers count the cost of shoppers engrossed by the Olympics. Official numbers for August are likely to reveal an outright fall in retail sales volumes in Great Britain after slowing to a crawl in July. The British Retail Consortium reported its worst month for sales this year, partly as a result of many shoppers staying away from London retail districts due to concerns over potential Olympic transportation chaos. And recruitment of professional staff seems to have been put on hold during the Olympics, with the Summer Games having an influence on firms' hiring plans, according to a new report. Some professional services firms decided not to interview applicants during the sporting events of recent weeks, said the Association of Professional Staffing Companies. This year, with the added distraction of the Olympics, some workplaces slowed almost to a standstill, and businesses may have decided to put recruitment on temporary hold, said Anne Swain, chief executive of the association. Summer is typically a slow time for professional jobs market, but many professionals seem to have heeded the government suggestions either to take time off during the games or to work from home, which had an influence on hiring. And a think tank has called for action to make sure the Olympics leaves a lasting legacy which boosts the UK economy. Centre for Cities said London should draw on lessons from previous host cities, otherwise the legacy could fall short. The group drew up a 5-point plan, including continued financial support for projects, a clear vision for future use of the Olympic Park, and help for people in East London to find jobs. Now the work begins, said the chief executive of the think tank, to make that success last not just for one generation, but for many. Proving, ladies and gentlemen, it's never too late to start thinking long term. The Olympics, it's a movement, and we all need one. Every day. And just one more note, news of the warm. Sea ice in the Arctic has shrunk to its smallest extent ever recorded, according to The Guardian newspaper, smashing the previous record minimum. Satellite images show the rapid summer melt has reduced the area of frozen sea to less than 3.5 million square kilometers this week, less than half the area typically occupied by ice just four decades ago. Arctic sea ice cover has been shrinking since the 1970s, but such a dramatic collapse in 1 year is highly unusual. Make your Arctic summer vacation plans now, won't you? As soon as they get that Russian ship dug up. ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, KCRW.com and HarryShearer.com, available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com, and available as a free podcast through KCRW.com. And be just like cleaning up that Arctic, if you would agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks as always to Pam Halstead. Thanks to, is it Adrian Bodnam? Yeah, at Global Radio here in London for help with today's broadcast. This program is represented on Twitter. Join the, oh, it's so close to 70,000. You can, it could be 70,000 by the time I get off the air. Followers, whatever they are, at The Harry Shearer. And the email address for this broadcast and music playlist of what you hear on this broadcast and so much more are at the absolutely brand new HarryShearer.com. Come on by. You can even buy stuff there. Like a Walmart. Smaller than a Walmart. Treat our workers just... The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates from the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the rubber promise and the home of the homeless. So long from London.